This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington. In Beijing today, talks got underway between representatives from the U.S., North Korea, and China aimed at ending the nuclear standoff on the Korean Peninsula. These talks are the first sign of compromise by either side since North Korea admitted a secret nuclear weapons program last October. In the intervening months, a war of words and symbolic gestures has raged between Washington and Pyongyang. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, demanded bilateral talks with the U.S. President Bush insisted South Korea, China, and Japan also be involved. Today, the negotiating table in Beijing has fewer chairs than the U.S. wanted, but more than the North Koreans originally demanded. On this hour of Talk of the Nation, what changed to get us here, and where are we headed? We'll look at the nuts and bolts of East Asian diplomacy, who's at the table and who isn't, the secret language of diplomatic gestures, and the different roles, desires, and influences of the countries involved. What direction will the Bush administration take after the talks finish on Friday, and how will the treatment of North Korea change issues of nonproliferation worldwide? Are there details of this story you're confused about, information you want about the players involved? What are your questions about the North Korean talks? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now in Studio 3A to set the scene at the talks is Robert Einhorn, former Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation under the Clinton administration, and currently a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You participated in past diplomatic talks with the North Koreans. Describe the scene for us behind the closed doors in these meeting rooms.
Well, I don't think the atmosphere is going to be terribly warm. After all, these are delegations, at least the U.S. and the North Korean delegations, that haven't met together since October, when the U.S. side confronted the North Koreans with the illegal North Korean uranium enrichment program. That was a pretty difficult confrontation. Things have only gotten worse since then. The North Koreans have ratcheted up the pressure, taken a succession of steps that put them in a position now to increase significantly the number of nuclear weapons they have. So the atmosphere will be kind of tense, I would think, in the room. It'll be a room in Beijing, probably supplied by the Chinese Foreign Ministry. It will be probably a three-sided table, a U or something, something like that. As you mentioned at the beginning, the United States very much wanted this to be a multilateral meeting of perhaps six countries, with the current participants China, U.S., and North Korea, but also South Korea, Japan, and Russia. North Koreans wanted to deal bilaterally with the U.S. They probably figured that they would have more leverage on the U.S. and be in a better position to extract concessions if they had a bilateral forum. The U.S. felt that this was a question for the international community. The international community was upset by North Korea's movement toward nuclear weapons, and North Korea's neighbors all have an important stake and ought to be represented. The Chinese helped broker this compromise. So it's a multilateral meeting, three countries. It's the smallest number of countries that you can have around the table and still call it multilateral. The South Koreans, who would like to play a leading role in these discussions, are upset that they've been excluded from a matter that has a tremendous effect on war and peace on the Korean Peninsula. And one of the U.S. objectives this time will be to try to persuade the North Koreans to permit both Japan and South Korea, and perhaps even Russia, to participate in the next round of negotiations. But it'll be pretty tense. The Chinese will be there in part as a facilitator. The U.S. wants them to play a full role, to express their views, to be active. But my guess is the Chinese will see itself playing a moderating kind of a role.
The North Koreans actually sort of suggested that this was indeed a bilateral talks today. I think they described China's role as limited to pouring tea and serving refreshments. A little flip, I'm sure, but describe further what you think we'll get from China in these talks.
Well, I'm sure the U.S. will have met before the U.S. goes into the tripartite negotiating room. The U.S. side will have met with the Chinese and will have pressed them very hard to play an active role, to do more than, to pass the tea, mm-hmm. But to express a strong substantive position as well. And I think the Chinese will be prepared to do that. But this is, again, it's going to be a fairly tense round. Don't expect much freewheeling by any of the delegations. Both the North Korean and American delegations will come with some fairly precise instructions from which they will be told they cannot deviate very much. They will begin the talks. The Chinese will welcome them. And then there'll be some opening presentations. Those will be set-piece affairs. They will be translated. I don't know whether the Chinese have arranged for simultaneous interpretation with earpieces or whether it will be a so-called consecutive interpretation.
Which can make for a long meeting.
It can double, or if there's going to be Chinese, can triple the time. Hopefully they can do this in an efficient way. But there'll be set-piece presentations, and then who knows? Maybe they'll break for coffee, or maybe they'll just continue in with each side probing the other side's position.
Now, these talks are supposed to last until Friday. What can we expect to come out by Friday? Is there going to be a roadmap forward coming out by Friday, or what can
No, I really wouldn't expect that at all. In fact, expectations are rather low for these three days of talks. I think the most we can expect is that each side will get its position on the table. It'll have the opportunity to probe, to seek clarifications, to probe for any flexibility on the other side. But I cannot imagine that they will be able to agree on any kind of roadmap. I think it's, in fact, probably unlikely that they will even be able to agree on a next meeting. Maybe I think the most that they will do is to agree to be in touch with each other through diplomatic channels to determine whether a next meeting is appropriate.
We want you to get in on this conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. If you've got a question or comment, we'll go now to Richard in Julian, California. Richard, you're on the air. Whoops, I'm sorry. I think I got Deborah.
Yes.
Deborah, please go ahead.
You?
Deborah, you're in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Yes, I am. My question is around the light water agreement that the U.S. entered into prior to the Bush administration. I'm trying to understand what motivated the U.S. not to to live up to that expectation. Is it because we're getting out of the despot business? I understand that we don't like the present government in Korea, and but I don't see that as being consistent with other despots that we've supported, Suharto, Duvalier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's a two-part question. Mm-hmm. Why did we get out of the the light water agreement? And is it because we just don't like this administration that's in Korea right now?
Yeah. Mr. Einhorn.
Yeah, well, I'd like to, Deborah, I think it wasn't that the U.S. got out of this 94 agreement. What happened was that we discovered that North Korea was violating the agreement. We began to get a lot of evidence of that last summer, and in October of 2002, we confronted the North Koreans with our evidence. Apparently, they are pursuing secretly a uranium enrichment program to produce enriched uranium for nuclear weapons in violation of the 1994 agreement. So, in effect, the North Koreans nullified that deal by violating it. That's why we're in the predicament we're in now.
We want to bring another guest into the discussion. Joining us now to give us some background on the talks is political science professor Han S. Park. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia in Athens, and he comes to us from the studios of member station WUGA. Thanks for being with us today, Professor Park.
Thank you for having me.
Let's step back a few weeks to when it looked like the U.S. and North Korea were deadlocked on the issue of talks. What changed to get both sides to the table today?
Now, I think both sides have been quite sincerely interested in resolving this impasse through diplomatic means. Neither side genuinely wanted to confront militarily. So with the Iraqi campaign now almost over, North Korea feels that North Korea might become next target. So this would prompt North Korea to bring this issue forefront and try to avoid possible military confrontation as early as possible. Mm-hmm. So that has one. And, of course, the countries surrounding North Korea are all opposed to any kind of military campaign on the part of the United States. So that might have made the Bush administration think more carefully and may have concluded that it has to explore all means diplomatically. And I think that made both parties make some concessions as far as the formula of the talks is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Now, China pressured North Korea to get them to the table. You're saying China's pressure was because it feared as well that the United States might take military action on the Korean Peninsula?
I think that might have been very much on the minds of the Chinese. China departing from their traditional posture, namely non-intervention in domestic affairs of other countries. Now China took initiative in hosting this meeting, and China does not want North Korea to be to collapse, nor does it want North Korea to arm with atomic bombs. It has a great deal of interest and ramifications for Chinese national interests. So unlike other issues, the North Korean military problem, nuclear problem, has become a very serious problem for the Beijing government.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Patrick in Sebastopol, California. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, what's going to be the incentive for the North Korean government to give up what appears to be its one major political leverage tool, which is nuclear power, to trust to a series of agreements that the United States would make with it, considering the current track record of a real lack of accountability of keeping agreements?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Let's, Professor Park, what would you say to that?
Yes, North Korea's economy is in shambles. I was there just 3 weeks ago, and the only leverage, as the caller suggested, is this card. They're not going to give it up very easily, but at the same time, they are not going to hang on to this permanently because they need to take care of their economy. So they're going to manufacture with this card security assurance. And I think it's wrong to suggest that North Korea is willing to give up their security matters in favor of economic assistance or humanitarian assistance.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the meeting between the U.S. and North Korean delegations in Beijing, which started today. What's on the table? What's at stake? And we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington. We're talking about this week's meeting in Beijing between the U.S. and North Korean delegates. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. For those following the administration's thinking on North Korea, things are starting to look a bit like deja vu. According to a memo leaked from the Pentagon earlier this week, hawks in the administration are floating the idea that the U.S. should team up with China to push for a change of regime in North Korea. That kind of talk runs counter to the prevailing State Department view that negotiations and a diplomatic solution are what's required. With us now to elaborate on the administration's wrangling is Newsweek's senior diplomatic correspondent Richard Wolff. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard, what's going on? Is this Iraq all over again?
I think it's actually worse than Iraq. You know, at least with Iraq, we kind of had a clear idea where the president was heading. There was all sorts of policy out there in terms of UN resolutions. And by the time people tried to fight about it, the White House made it clear that decisions were already made. North Korea has been described to me as the very worst of the infighting for the administration, the most intense battles over foreign policy, because there is this fundamental disagreement about whether to engage or to have a showdown with the communist North.
Mm-hmm. Well, which side has the upper hand this time, Pentagon or State?
At the moment, the people who are at State who want to pursue negotiations have got the upper hand right now. But the Pentagon and conservatives throughout the administration, also at State, but particularly in the vice president's office, are fighting very strongly to have this kind of confrontation.
Mm-hmm. And what about the president? Where does he stand on it?
Well, the president feels very strongly about Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader. He has famously told Bob Woodward that he loathes him. But he's also signed off on these kinds of carrot-and-stick approach, the economic package for the North, renewed talks. I think that's really alarmed people, particularly at the Pentagon, where they see the intelligence on the nuclear programs that the North has, and they really want to head this off in a much more aggressive way.
Mm-hmm. Why does this ideological division keep coming up in the administration's foreign policy? Is it a sign of paralysis, or does the debate actually make the eventual policy stronger?
That's a great question. I think there are kind of two reasons here. First of all, this is a National Security Council, a collection of the principals, which has a huge amount of power compared to previous administrations, including Bush 1, where decisions are really made between people like Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Powell, and they're making these decisions because the clear policy guidance doesn't come through until a very late stage from the president and from his National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. So in the kind of vacuum, these sides have, fight it out amongst themselves until, something very late comes in from the president himself.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the North Koreans make of all this? Are they following all the twists and turns, all the subtleties, or do they just take a worst-case view?
It's always hard to read the North Koreans, but from all the anecdotal evidence we've seen from defectors and other sources, Kim Jong-un himself surfs the web, reads an avid consumer of the Western media, loves to read about stories about himself. They're very unsettled, of course, but they're also very proud and nationalistic, and they think they're ready for a fight if one is to come. I mean, their top goal is to get a non-aggression pact, so clearly they're thinking much more in terms of military conflict than the Bush administration.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is Newsweek's senior diplomatic correspondent. He writes about the administration's position on North Korea in this week's installment of his online column. Robert Einhorn, what do you make of this division in the administration over North Korea? Is it serious, do you think?
I think it is very serious, and it's possible for both sides to come together on a posture at the current round of talks in Beijing, there's not enough agreement to get them past opening statements. It's a kind of compromise. The State Department wins in actually engaging in Beijing, but I think the more hardline elements win by constraining the kind of message that the American delegation can give the North Koreans. So it's an uneasy compromise. It's not going to get them very far this week. They'll have to evaluate what happens by Friday evening and then figure out what to do next.
Mm-hmm. Professor Park, you were in North Korea just a few weeks ago. What do you see as the mood on the street among the people of North Korea and in Pyongyang?
Generally, the public seems to be believing what their leadership told them to, and that is they are prepared to fight against any adversarial forces. But at the same time, the leadership seemed to be somewhat nervous about and anxious about the U.S. policy after Iraq. So I think what is very important in the Beijing talk is the two important people there is Lee Kun, who is a seasoned diplomat, was ambassador to the United Nations just last year, until last year. And there's a military number two man in North Korea. And that means that they take these talks very, very seriously. They would like to avoid military confrontation by making the United States make some concessions on the security arrangement. So Cho Myung-nok, the General Cho, has a sizable influence and leverage in the military. I think the generally North Korea is very nervous and highly interested in the outcome of this talk. I'm not as pessimistic as others in seeing the prospects of these talks, and I think they will probably agree on future agenda. The agenda is likely to be more inclusive than one-sided demand.
Right. If you were going to line up on one side of the administration or the other, the Pentagon or the State Department side, as Mr. Wolf just outlined, where would you line up? Are you?
I think there is no other way. The division in the administration in Washington seemingly is because of their misunderstanding or bits and pieces of information of North Korea that led to different assumptions. The hawkish people believe that if we use the military force, maybe North Koreans will shrink. The more conciliatory people think that there will be retaliatory gestures or military campaign against the South, which will certainly cause a catastrophe. So I think it's different perceptions of North Korea that led to the disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Park.
You're welcome.
Han S. Park is the director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia in Athens. He was in the studios of member station WUGA. While stability in East Asia is the obvious goal for the talks with North Korea, the situation also has implications for the entire world. A nuclear stalemate on the Korean Peninsula threatens the delicate balance of destructive power achieved with the end of the Cold War. Joining us by phone is Ash Carter, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration and current co-director of the Preventative Defense Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Let me give you this scenario. The talks fall apart. The timeline for North Korea's nuclear arsenal speeds up. What happens in the rest of the region?
Well, if we allow North Korea to go nuclear, which I don't believe the United States will do and can afford to do, but let's hypothesize, or said differently, ask ourselves, what's the problem here? There are two main types of truly deeply negative consequences. The first is that North Korea sells everything they make, narcotics, missiles, and they might sell nuclear weapons that they made to those who would use them against us, terrorists or other states. North Korea is not going to be around forever because of the contradictions of its own system. Now, its collapse has been predicted for as long as I've been associated with this issue, and it's still there. But at some point, you can imagine a collapse of the North Korean regime, and then you have to ask yourself the same thing we asked ourselves when the Soviet Union collapsed, which is what happens to the nukes? Do they get loose? Mm-hmm. And then even if North Korea holds on to its nukes, what does it mean for the global non-proliferation regime if the world's most isolated Stalinist throwback goes nuclear and nobody does anything about it? Does that start others around the world thinking that they should go nuclear as well? Does it start others in the region? So this has repercussions that are not just regional, they're global, and that are about as profound as anything in the security field.
Mm-hmm. What do we know exactly about whether or not North Korea has nuclear weapons right now, or whether it's reprocessing to make them?
There are. It's rather confusing. It's a very good question. There are three nuclear weapons programs that are talked about with respect to North Korea. The first is a program they carried out way back in 1989 when the first President Bush was president. And at that time, we know they got some plutonium, but we don't know how much. The upper end of our range of estimates is one or two bombs worth. And so when you hear the CIA say, we think North Korea might have one or two bombs already, that goes way back to 1989. The second problem is the one that causes the current crisis, and that is at a place called Yongbyon, there is five or six bombs worth of plutonium in the form of reactor fuel rods ready to be reprocessed into bomb material. So they're only a few months away, if they have one or two now, of getting another five or six. Then there's a third program, the uranium in program. Uranium's the other metal besides plutonium that you could make bombs out of. And that is the program that we now know they secretly started some years ago, and that the U.S. administration confronted them with in the last time there were talks between North Korea and the United States. That's a program that will eventually make lots of bombs, but not for years to come. So the one to worry about right now is the second one, the five or six bombs worth of plutonium at Yongbyon. That's what the crisis is about.
Mm-hmm. Robert Einhorn, I want to bring you back into this discussion. North Korea's drive to build a nuclear arsenal certainly gives new life to issues of nonproliferation around the world. Which countries outside of East Asia are watching this with the most interest, and what lessons do you think they're going to take from it?
Well, as you suggested, in East Asia, they're watching, and if North Korea goes ahead and reprocesses this plutonium and continues with its enrichment program and ends up with a small arsenal, you can be sure that some countries in East Asia will be rethinking their security needs. South Korea will be looking at what's happening north of the DMZ and wondering whether they should have nuclear weapons. Japan may even begin debating whether they can afford to do without. But countries like Iran, who are seeking nuclear weapons, are well along their path. They want to know how the world will react to North Korea. After all, they saw an example next door in Iraq of what happened to one government that was seeking weapons of mass destruction, and particularly nuclear weapons. But they'll want to look at another case of North Korea. And if they think that North Korea can get away with this, this might make them more willing to accept the risks of pursuing their own program.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to some callers now. Let's hear from Amy in Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Amy.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. If the U.S. knew that the North Koreans were pursuing this nuclear program and we were still willing to give them food and medical aid, why then would we declare them in violation, deny the aid, when they had basically accepted our invitation to come clean about the program? And I'll take the comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy. Robert Einhorn, you were involved with the Clinton administration in these questions.
Right. Well, in 94, we were aware of this program. In exchange for two light water reactors and heavy fuel oil shipments, we were hoping that this would freeze that program dead in its tracks. While there was good evidence that, in fact, the plutonium program had been frozen, we found out, beginning in the late 90s, we had suspicions, but those were confirmed last summer, that they had another program that Ash Carter talked about, the uranium enrichment program. So our hope was that they would freeze the program. We weren't providing them benefits with the knowledge that they were going ahead and violating their commitments.
Let's go to another caller. Let's see here. Robert in Battle Creek, Michigan. Hello, Robert. Hello, Robert. Are you there? I think we've lost Robert. Ash Carter, let me ask you, how can the U.S. Stop North Korea from going nuclear? How can the U.S. stop South Korea from going nuclear if North Korea chooses to go nuclear?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm not sure we can. We were able, South Korea, had a nuclear weapons program some years ago, and we managed to talk them, our allies, out of their nuclear program on two grounds. One was, your brethren to the north don't have them, so you don't need to have them. And number two, we are your allies, and we will help protect you, and therefore you don't need nuclear weapons for your own protection. Now, the South Koreans, if they look north and they see North Korea getting away with it, there's going to be a feeling of envy, a feeling, why should we be deprived of the ultimate weapon if North Korea gets the ultimate weapon? There will even be a feeling in South Korea, and this is very detectable, that these North Korean nuclear weapons might someday belong to us, because don't forget that the animosities in Asia run deep. And South Korea doesn't only worry about North Korea, it worries about others of its neighbors that have been antagonists in the past. So once you get this fire burning in East Asia, the ancient, not ancient, but the antagonisms going back to the last century are so deep that, as Bob Einhorn said, the flame can spread very quickly.
Let's go to Dave in Claremont, California. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to get the guests' opinions on how genuine they think China is on a regime change in North Korea, since, in my view, they are using North Korea as a buffer zone for, democratic ideals.
Mm-hmm. Ask Carter?
Yeah, well, the Chinese don't want regime change in North Korea. They might want regime transformation, that is, North Korea getting less strange, less isolated, less hostile, less weird. But they don't want regime change if that means a catastrophe in which the government implodes and 22 million, that's the population of North Korea, poor people, which they are, suddenly come flooding across the border looking for jobs or looking for food. And there's no longer a buffer between China and South Korea and the United States, its ally. So the collapse of North Korea is not in China's interest. That's why China says, hey, look, we're against nuclear weapons in North Korea, but we don't want to precipitate the collapse of North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much. Ash Carter, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration and current co-director of the Preventative Defense Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And thanks to Robert Einhorn, Assistant Secretary of State. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation in the second Clinton administration, currently a senior advisor in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about North Korea. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.